The cover story in the March edition of History Today is written by Thomas Dubois, and it's called Asia and the Old World Order. Now, there's been much talk in recent years of the 21st century being the Asian century. But if we think back even as recently as 1997, when there was the Asian financial crisis, there was a sense in the West that it had overcome any threat from Asia and the developing world. And we had Francis Fukuyama's End of History thesis, for example, which proclaimed the victory of liberal democracy for all time, or so it seemed. Nowadays, we know that things are very, very different, and there is no doubt that Asia will be a major, major power in the 21st century, particularly China. And yet, as Thomas Dubois makes out, and makes very, very plain, Asia was a significant power in the 19th century as well. And in fact, what we've seen is something of an interregnum, I suppose, within this. And in fact, the world was remarkably well connected during the end of the 19th century. Can you tell us about your basic thesis, Thomas?
The basic thesis comes from the fact that I'm a China historian first. And we always approach history with the idea that China is in the center, because that's certainly how China sees its own history. It's China first and everybody else revolving around them. And when I was working in Singapore, it was a bit of a jarring experience to hear other people with other views about the 19th century in particular and British colonialism and the degree to which Britain had transformed the world. And so after a few years of discussing this with colleagues, the conclusion that I came to is that we're both right, that Britain did indeed transform the world, but the reason that it transformed the world was that it recognized how big it was, which is, in fact, not very big at all, certainly not compared to Asia. So the thesis that I came up with, which I don't know if it's a particularly original one, is that the reason Europe and the West more generally became a global force is that it interacted with Asia. It interacted with the world, but Asia always had a particular place. Now, Asia was very different from Africa. You have the scramble for concessions in Africa. You have nativized elites in places like Latin America. Asia is substantively different. It is too big to control and also too big to ignore. So Asia had to be treated differently. And in the end, what happened was Europe adapted to Asia. And it's hard to see this, pardon me, it's a bit hard to see this because when you look on a map, you see British India, French Indochina, you see the Netherlands East Indies. But in fact, European power was much more limited in those places. And what comes out of this period, the post-colonial period, is a world that is much more equal.
What's very striking, Thomas, in your article is that you make the point of the transition in Britain, which I think is a major influence on its relationship with Asia, and that's the shift from manufacturing to finance. And you talk about a shift from Manchester to London. How much did that affect Britain and the West's relationship with Asia and China in particular?
That again, that's one of those moments where a knowledge of the earlier period is a hindrance rather than a help. I think the iconic moment for most people in the relationship between Britain and China is the Opium Wars, and that's, of course, the 1840s. And that is Britain forcibly opening China up to trade. And that you know, that has a very iconic moment, not just because opium is involved, but because China is being brought into the world's commercial system, kicking and screaming. They did not want to join. They wanted to join on their own terms. But that was not going to be the order of the day. By one generation later, Britain was no longer trading in opium. And on the one hand, it was because China was growing their own opium. But the real reason is that it was no longer profitable. And this is something that I think certainly historians of Asia would have trouble appreciating. The reason that Japan example, took over the market for textiles in Asia is not because Britain couldn't compete with Japan, but because British manufacturers had other things to do. Textiles were no longer the most profitable product for them to be making. So it's a surprise to a China historian, certainly, the degree to which foreign interests in Asia were themselves transforming. And really what did it, what prompted the change, not just in China, but throughout East Asia, was the militarization of Asia itself. So what was all of this money that when you have the sale of government debt to China, to Japan, and of course to all of the colonies themselves, a lot of it is going to infrastructure, a lot of it is going to railroads, medical campaigns, etc. But the majority of it was going to war and armaments. And so this was by far the most profitable industry for British money to be investing in was in finance itself.
And you use a term, Thomas, that I know is not your own, but is one that you seem to subscribe to, which is railway imperialism. I wonder if you could explain what you mean by that.
Well, this is another one of these examples when looking at what's happening in the world today is a very good mirror for what's happening historically. Right now, a lot of people are very nervous about Chinese influence abroad, outside of China, and in particular Africa. And they refer to a kind of new Chinese colonialism. And really, what are the Chinese doing in Africa? They're building railways. They're building airports. They're building universities, stadia, etc. They're building infrastructure. And in the process of building infrastructure, they are making unfavorable loans, unfavorable from the point of Africa. They're making loans that are very favorable to themselves. They are using their own workers. They're making a gift of this infrastructure, but they are very certainly getting something out of it. Unique access to raw materials, for example, influence in the government. And so the building of infrastructure has numerous knock-on effects that I would say are very similar to what was happening in East Asia 100 years ago. There was immense competition over railway construction. And in particular, I keep going back to China, not just because I'm a China historian, but because it was the only country of that size that wasn't modernizing on its own or colonized. Thailand is another example, but compared to China, it's a much less significant game. The real competition at about the turn of the century was for the construction of railways. Britain, the United States, Japan to a much lesser degree, in particular Russia. Everybody was trying to make sure that when they had a treaty with China, that provisions for railway construction would be put in, because with the railroad, you don't just build the line itself. You get to commercialize along the line. You have a piece of land of a few kilometers in either direction, and you can station troops. You can build coal mines. You can build industry. So this, China, of course, was never formally colonized, but how did China get divided into these so-called spheres of influence? At the heart of every one was a foreign railway. And this is something that the Chinese themselves were very aware of. So when we look at, for example, Chinese farmers or Chinese soldiers tearing up railway tracks, the common explanation is, oh, they're just superstition. They don't like foreign things. Well, there may have been some of that. Certainly there was. But they're also not stupid. They realize that a foreign railroad going straight into the heart of their territory is doing more than delivering goods. It's delivering foreign power, which again, until that point, it had all been, this is where we get the term gunboat diplomacy. It had all been concentrated along the shore. It's the railways that brought foreign power from the gunboats straight into the heart of the continent.
And how much do you think Chinese leadership, Chinese businessmen, Chinese strategists today are aware of those precedents so far as the way in which the West worked on China? How much, say, that influences China's work in Africa now, the example you just given? Are they aware of that? Is it?
They certainly are. I would say Chinese leaders, more than most, are particularly cognizant of history, of both their own view of history, which is of course very highly stylized, let's be honest about that, but also of their place in history, how history will view them. So, for example, if you ever see in the news that someone would refer to Chinese railroad building in Africa, or you know, giving medicine, or any of these things that they do, as new colonialism, that's one of the few times that you'll see Chinese spokesperson sort of break that icy demeanor. They're very genuinely angry at that charge, and I think with some reason. The same thing is if you refer to Tibet in this way, because they would consider themselves to have been the victims of colonization.
And that's a point. And that's a point that's made very explicitly by Julia Lovell in her recent History of the European Wars. It's essentially that there's a great deal of cognizance in China of something that the West has largely forgotten, and it really is time that the West rediscovered interest in the Opium Wars. There is an attempt by the West to keep China as one, because it is this valuable resource, this valuable market. In 1894, when China and Japan go to war, for instance, there's great concern in the West, isn't there?
Oh, very much so. This was, again, a surprise, because the dominant narrative, certainly in China, is something called Fenghua, carving up the melon. The idea that all of the foreign powers are ganging up on China and they all have to band together to carve up China. And it's only because of the stroke of fate that they weren't able to carve up China. Actually, nobody wanted China to be carved up. And this was this actually goes back a few decades. Chinese treaties with foreign powers, Japan was a big exception, had something akin to a most favored nation status, that if China gave a concession to France, for example, they can build churches in coastal cities. All of the other European powers in the United States got that as well. So there was very much, from the Chinese point of view, an attempt to make sure that all of the powers were equal, and the idea is that they would play off each other for that reason. But it kept them in a balance with each other that is exemplified by the American policy of the open door, which comes after the First Sino-Japanese War. The point is that nobody could afford to have what happened in China, in Africa, happen in China, scramble for concessions. The only people who could possibly have benefited from that would have been Russia or Japan, because they're, of course, adjacent to China. Those are the only two powers that could have afforded to send in a genuine occupation force. And, of course, an occupation force for China would have been financially disastrous for anybody who did it. Mm-hmm. So even those powers, they may have been prompted by national pride, but I don't think anybody would have looked at that as a realistic plan. The logic that would have driven China to be partitioned would have been the classic large logic of late-era colonialism, the denial of territory, even if it's useless territory, even if it's going to be costly to administer, we have to get it before somebody else does. And that could certainly have happened. And so all of the Western powers were able to keep a sort of a gentleman's agreement that China would remain intact. And that all changed after the Sino-Japanese War, when Japan actually did the unthinkable and they took a piece of territory, what is now the city of Dalian, on the Liaodong Peninsula. And this is why you have the intervention of Russia, France, and Germany, is because, not because they cared about the Liaodong Peninsula itself, nobody had real interest there, but because once one power takes a piece of territory, the only logical response is for everybody else to do so, and nobody wanted to get pulled into that. So it was surprisingly high on the order of priorities for all of these countries, particularly given its distance and particularly given that it was a sovereign territory.
And so, finally, Thomas, can I ask you about something that's perhaps a softer issue? A point that you make about a cultural one, and that is another legacy of this period of the 19th century, which is very much with us today, and that's such things as passports and quarantine, for example, which is stimulated in some part the modern system by the relationship between Asia and the West.
I think quarantine is a very good example of how Asia prompted what's essentially a European system. I mean, so many of the institutions in the world are European in origin. The Westphalian system, the passport system, the quarantine system, these all began in Europe. The question is, how did a set of European concerns and institutions and all of the cultural ideas that go along with them, how did they become globalized? They became globalized not in the context of empire as much as in the context of adaptation to Asia. And quarantine is a very good example of this. The history of quarantine goes in two pretty discernible stages. One is when Europe itself discovers quarantine, and that's in the context of cholera in the mid-19th century, when they finally get together, and all of these countries, of course, everyone had their own rules of quarantine, and what do you do when you enter another territory, and Russia in particular was very good at this, because they're a massive land empire, and they had very big problems with plague in particular. But the institution of a continent-wide system, and one in which, in particular, the ships of one country would be subject to the laws of another country, and that this would be standardized across Europe, that was relatively late. It was only the later decades of the 1800s of the 19th century. That's stage one. How did it become a global system? It all comes down to money, actually. You have cities like Singapore. You have cities like Hong Kong or Yokohama, where they may have been either belong to Japan or belong to China or belong to one or the other of the empires. But trade was so interconnected, and it was such a high-stakes game. I mean, that's always something to remember with Asia, is that there was so much money to be made in Asia that people were willing to do drastic things to make sure that they could keep their feet in that market. And it's about the turn of the century that you have, for example, you have a plague in Hong Kong. And now it's not just the British sending their scientists to fight plague in Hong Kong. The Japanese go as well. And the Russians send Swiss bacteriologists. And everybody has there's prestige, of course, involved in this, but everybody has a stake in making sure that Hong Kong stays plague-free, because everybody needs Hong Kong. And the same thing happens a few years later in a railway town in North China called Harbin. You have the very first time in Chinese history that you have an international conference on a matter of Chinese domestic security. So the interconnectivity of the world, plus the fact that nobody can leave Asia, and this was the point that this research really brought home to me over and over, is that Europe was much more heavily dependent on Asia financially than the reverse.
Yeah, well, thank you, Thomas. That's a tremendously stimulating article, and I think it just proves the old one that things don't change in time. And your article on the Asian century is what we might call the first Asian century, Asia in the 19th century, and its relationship with the West is the cover story in the March edition of History Today. So thank you very much, Thomas. Thank you very much.
Thank you.